Welcome back to the FKT podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today I'm joined by Katya Gorjeva, who recently set the supported FKT for Armenia's Trans-Caucasian Trail. Join us to hear all about the mountains and challenges of this seldom traveled route, as well as learn the value of always wearing bigger shoes. Thank you, Katya, for coming on the show today to talk about your Trans-Caucasian Trail FKT across Armenia. This is not a trail I knew of prior to reading about your FKT, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't either. So I was wondering if you could just start out by describing the route, what the trail's like, whether it's mountainous, what the trail tread's like, just kind of paint a picture for our listeners.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Heather. And I am so happy to talk about the trail because it was so different from what we expected it to be. I think it's hard to have an idea of what to expect with a trail like this. So the trail itself, it goes basically from the border with Iran to the border with Georgia through Armenia. So that's about 820 kilometers. But for such a small country, Armenia has such diverse landscape. So from one day to the next, the topography was so, so different. Starting in the south by Iran, it was very dry, quite jagged mountains, a lot of grass. And then moving further up, then it gets into sort of more deserty areas. And then the highest point on the trail is covered in snow. We had to go around a lot of snow fields. And then the north of the country is really green and wet. So very mountainous all through the country is what I will say. But so stunning and amazing to see like such variety over such a short period of time and such a, I guess, relatively short distance for a country.
Right. And were you mainly on single track trail or was it roadways? What was under the feet?
Yeah. So the best tracks that I had were Jeep tracks, 4x4 tracks. But I will say that they were few and far between in some sections. The first day was mostly bushwhacking, no trail. And they've put so much work into that southern section. So I've heard that it was even worse a couple years ago. I think I was the first person to come through that southern section this year is what I was told. So no one had gone through these bushes before me. And I was warned that June would be particularly bad for bushwhacking just because everything is super overgrown. I think by the time you get to August, September, a lot of the plants are dead because it's just too hot. Mm-hmm. But in June, things are really, really thick. So it was really a mix. I think there were some sections that were more on asphalt roads through towns, but by and large, it was livestock tracks. So a lot of cow tracks and sheep tracks, 4x4 Jeep tracks. And in some sections, there was good single track trail in areas where it was maintained, but it really varies. And there was, yeah, quite a lot of off trail that we had to go through.
Starting an FKT with a bushwhack does not sound
like
a good start.
Yes.
Whenever I hear about going through thick brush, the first thing I think of is ticks. Were there a lot of ticks? Was that a concern?
Yeah, definitely. Ticks were a concern. We found a couple on me in the first week. So glad that we got that checked. But the bigger risk in those kind of areas is actually snakes in Armenia. So in that southern section, there's a lot of venomous snakes. So there's like Armenian mountain vipers. And I feel so lucky that I didn't meet any in that first section because I know people have before. And there's really nothing you can do. So a lot of that first day bushwhacking was also just using my poles to keep hitting the grass in front of me, which sometimes went up to my chest. Like it was pretty intense.
Wow.
And that was the better. There was then through actual thorny bushes. The grass was better, but I was more worried about snakes there. So yeah, there's a lot of wildlife to watch out for, actually. That was probably the scary part.
Yeah, I saw you mentioned snakes and I was wondering, yeah, I guess I wasn't thinking about bushwhacking and encountering snakes, but yeah, that would be really bad because you can't see them.
Yeah.
Or see, and they may or may not move for you. So you brought up wildlife. So let's kind of jump into that because the thing I feel like when I was watching your recap videos, that you mentioned so many times were sheepdogs. Can you tell me about the sheepdogs?
Yeah.
Yes. Tell us about the sheepdogs.
Yeah. It's very like therapeutic to keep talking about the sheepdogs because I feel like I'm still processing. But no, I mean, I genuinely think that that was the scariest like wildlife, I guess, or not even wildlife, but scariest animals that I encountered on the trails. Just because they're mandate is to protect livestock in the mountains from like bears and wolves. So they're really huge dogs, really aggressive, very territorial. And often there's multiple around a herd or around a herder camp. So sometimes they'll be chained up, but most often there is one that's chained up and then another one that's kind of walking around. And if the shepherd is there, then it's fine and they kind of can call the dog off. But there were a couple instances where there was no shepherd around. And that's pretty scary because they get really big. Like there was one section where I was going through really thick fog, couldn't maybe see like 5-10 meters in front of me. And I saw this shape in the fog, which I thought was like a small cow. And as I got closer, I realized it was actually a sheepdog. And at the same time, I realized, yeah, that it was a dog. It realized like that I was there and it was not happy. So I had to go way off path in the fog, which could have, you know, thankfully it ended fine in that I was able to divert, but they are quite aggressive. And so I think that this kind of safety tool that I used the most was my dog whistle. And I always kind of had my pepper spray and bear spray close by. Yeah, I only had to use the pepper spray once when a dog charged, but usually they just kind of make a lot of noise until you pass.
Wow. I am personally quite afraid of off-leash dogs. So this sounds terrifying to me.
I wasn't happy about it either.
So. I mean, obviously, I guess these dogs are just doing their job, but that's still pretty terrifying. Did the bear spray work on the dog?
So I kept the bear spray tucked away most of the time. So when I was passing areas where there might be sheepdogs, I had my pepper spray out and the dog whistle. And I guess there's some science behind this, but small dogs didn't really care about the dog whistle, but the bigger sheepdogs were affected by it and at least stopped. And then maybe they'd keep walking towards me and barking, but then they'd let me go past. So I only really had to use the pepper spray, as I said, that one time when the dog actually charged at me. But I think it was a combination of dog whistle, my poles, and then the spray that deterred it. And the bear spray, I really only took out if I was in the forest alone or if I was up on a mountain. As I left villages, I was often stopped by people who were really concerned that I was going up into the mountains or the hills. And they often asked me if I knew that there were bears and wolves up there, which isn't the thing you want to hear as you're going up alone because there's no one up there. I didn't see either, thankfully. Mm-hmm. The biggest wild animal that I saw was wild boars a couple times, but they were really scared of me. But I know a hiker actually saw a bear on the trail a couple weeks after me. So I think I was lucky, but I also spoke to myself a lot in those areas.
Are there a lot of bears or are they very few and far between?
So hiking is not as popular yet in Armenia as, you know, hopefully it will be in the future. And that means that bears don't know to associate humans with food out in nature. I think historically they've been chased by farmers and sheepdogs and they've been hunted. They are scared of humans. And so I think their first instinct is to run away unless you get between a bear and her offspring. So I don't think there are a ton of bears. And I think the ones that are there are pretty scared of humans. So speaking to people, that wasn't the biggest risk. I think you have to be aware of your surroundings. You don't want to startle anyone. But unlike some places in North America, for example, you don't have to be afraid that they're going to attack you. I mean, I'm still worried about it, but less so.
Yeah, I know that they're protected here in the United States. So there are certain areas that have a lot of bears, very dense. So you're almost guaranteed to run into one.
Actually, we thought we'd run into one because there's a section that's dubbed the Bear Corridor. It's this 120-kilometer section. And I actually asked my friend May, who was helping to crew, I said, can you do this section with me? Because I just recruited her for like some of the shorter, scary sections because there were some days where emotionally it was quite tough. So having someone else there was nice. And we didn't see any bears, but we were also, again, trying to make a lot of noise. But usually people will see a lot of bear tracks and droppings and things like that in that area. And maybe we're just not good enough at seeing the tracks, but they're definitely around there.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. So backing up a little bit more to the why of the hike, this is your first FKT on the FKT website. Maybe you've done some that aren't on the site, but I'm wondering why you chose this trail. And I believe you mentioned your goal was 22 days. So why did you choose 22 days?
Yeah. So just for some context, I lived in Armenia for a couple of years during high school. So there was that kind of emotional connection for me to the country. And I think, especially because it was between the ages of 16 and 18, those were some really, really formative years for me. And that's also when I started running. And that's when I did my first 10K. And that was what sparked all of the longer distance running that I did afterwards. So for me, on a personal level, it was quite symbolic to come back to the country and do something like this, because I knew that the trail was being developed. I think it started to be built while I was studying there, but it was only released to hikers in the last 3 or 4 years officially.
Okay.
And that coincided well with my journey into trail running and ultra running. So for me, it was a thought of this would be really cool to run someday, to try and run. And that's sort of where the idea started. Our primary goal was not an FKT. That came a little bit later in the process, thinking about what does this look like? Has anyone done it before? And no one had tried to run the trail before. No one had tried to, someone has actually done an FKT or established an FKT last year. But because the trail changed from 2023 to 2024 for security reasons, there was a part of there's like a 50 kilometer part of the trail that was cut out. So this is a new variation of the trail. And that person who did it last year did it in, I believe, 30 days. But it was self-supported. So it's also a different classification. And our primary goal was to see, can this trail be run? The conclusion was mostly not. So a lot of it ended up being speed hiking, with most of the running coming at the end. And the reason why we chose 22 days was because that made the most sense in terms of how we were breaking the trail down from town to town. The trail is pretty remote in some sections, so that the important thing when trying to run it especially is being able to get to shelter at the end of the day. So not being too ambitious, but also pushing the boundaries of what is possible, especially cumulatively day on day, seeing what you can do, especially because the overall elevation of the trail ended up being something like 33,000 meters. So it's quite a lot over that distance, which meant that I was doing maybe 1,500, 600 a day on average. But in practice, some days were 2,500, some days were 1,000. So it really varied. And it meant that there was a mix of difficulty in days. There were some really, really tough days, which had to be tough because we needed to get from point A to point B. And I can come back to this, but the first day was the riskiest day in terms of distance that we planned, because there was just nothing between that first town and the village that I stopped in. And there were very few bailout points, if any. So every day was planned in this way of, okay, what's the furthest that I can get in a safe way, not knowing the terrain, not knowing the conditions. And actually some of the longer days, which I was more scared of, ended up being more enjoyable and easy because they were on like more marked trails. And some of the shorter days, which I thought this is going to be a rest day, it took so long because of the bushwhacking and other conditions. So in retrospect, I think knowing what we know now, we could have maybe structured it slightly differently. But when you're not running with a tent, the way that we structured it, I think, was the most risk that we were willing to take in this trail, not knowing what was there and not knowing how my body would respond to the distance and elevation and everything else.
Right. So let's dive a little deeper into the logistics of this. You mentioned your friend May. Who else did you have crewing you? How big was your team? How often were you seeing them? Maybe walk us through a typical day there.
Yeah, so my partner, Jonas, was there the entire time. He was managing all of the logistics, driving the car, tracking the inReach, giving me maps for every day, giving me briefings with as much information as he could find on terrain and things to look out for. And there wasn't so much information. There were some people who thru-hiked the last couple of years, so we really pulled as much as possible from their accounts, but it was limited. So Jonas took the whole logistics task, which was a huge, huge effort. And then my friend May was there for the first 10 days. She had crewed me last year for my first 100K race in the UK, and she was amazing. And it was really special to have her there. Then my sister joined for the last week when everyone was totally like depleted battery. She just came in with fresh energy and helped us out. So that was great. It was always a team of two. And then in the middle section, it was like a self-supported piece. But I did that with Megan Neal, who's the executive director of the trail. So it was really special for her to agree to do that middle section with me in the Gegan Mountains, because that's totally inaccessible unless you've got a 4x4 car. So we were self-supported for that piece.
So were you just running from town to town? So you only saw Jonas and whoever else was there in the morning. And then in the evening, were you staying in the towns at night? How did that work?
It really depended on what the roads were like, to be honest, and what the terrain was like. So the first day, there were no checkpoints and the team couldn't even get to my end point, so the town at the end of the day, because the only road that got to that town was too close to the border with Azerbaijan. And that was a risk that we weren't willing to take because that's close to disputed territory. It wasn't worth the risk to us for them to just get there for that one night. So the first 2 days, I didn't see them at all until the last section of day two, when I was so honestly broken and in pain that May came out to meet me on the trail with shoes a size bigger because my feet were just in so much pain from day one. Day one was a mess, to be honest. I ended the day in a way that we totally weren't expecting. All of my devices ran out of battery. I got stuck on the mountain in the dark, had to run down this mountainside in the dark. So by the end of that day, my toenails were pretty gone, the two big ones. And so the second day, I could barely walk downhill. So that's why I needed that change of shoes really, really badly to make it. But anyway, that was a tangent story. But I think after that experience, we realized, or the team realized, Jonas took the lead on this and said, checkpoints make such a difference in terms of me feeling okay and safe. Because after that, the experience of the first day, I got really anxious on some of the next days when it was getting closer to dark, or I was going up onto a mountain by myself because I was just so scared of being in that situation again. And so they made this huge effort to try and put more checkpoints in where it wasn't planned. So I think the most that they ever did in one day was 4 checkpoints, and it was incredible. It was the best. Mm-hmm. It was such a huge effort from them. And I think that day was 50K long or something, but it felt so easy because they just showed up and they brought so much energy and there's this huge motivation to meet them. But then equally, there were other days where they tried to get somewhere, realized that the road on the map wasn't an actual road. We were in a 2-wheel drive. It wasn't a 4-wheel drive. So it just wasn't possible for them to go on some of those roads. So sometimes I got a message on the inReach just saying, sorry, we can't make this checkpoint. So it was also like having enough supplies for if that didn't work out on some of the days, we kind of anticipated that it might not be possible. But mostly it was 1 to 2 checkpoints a day, which made a huge, huge difference to my mental well-being and motivation to keep going.
There's several directions I want to go from there. So the first thing I want to know is where you stayed the first night. Did you get a hotel in town? Were you just sleeping on the side of the mountain in the dark? How did that end up?
Yeah, so I was close to sleeping on the side of the mountain in the dark, to be honest, because essentially this fog had rolled in. I was still maybe 10 kilometers from town, which on a normal day, this would take me an hour, right? Especially because it wasn't so much climbing left. So I was like, we're going to be fine. Also, Jonas on the inReach was like, you've got a couple hours of daylight left. You're going to be totally fine. The super thick fog rolled in and it was again, a lot of bushwhacking on the side of the mountain. And then I realized when I went to go charge my phone that the power bank that we'd also charged last night suddenly was dead. And we still don't know why this was the case. There was a huge lightning storm the night before I started. The whole night was just this super intense lightning thunder. So maybe something short-circuited and maybe that's what happened. That's our theory. But it meant that my watch was about to die. My phone was about to die. And I still had this distance to go. And I had a paper map as a backup, but it was getting darker. So I tried to move as fast as I could. And at some point, it was super foggy, getting dark. I pulled out my head torch. And it was also on low battery. And we'd also charged it the night before, which is why we think maybe something short-circuited because we were so careful to charge everything. And it was in that situation where I passed this old shed that had been used for cows at some point. I mean, like totally falling apart. And I seriously considered just going inside and using my emergency blanket and just calling it quits for the day because I didn't know what was going to be next. And as it got darker and darker, I just thought, this is not good. Because even if the head torch had full battery, they don't work so well in the fog. So that was the fear. And everyone had warned me that all the animals come out at dusk. And so I considered finding any form of human-made shelter and just staying there. But I said, no, I need to keep pushing. And eventually I got down into this valley with my phone on 2%. My watch was out of battery already. And I could see that from this valley, there was a tiny creek that would lead eventually to the village. And I could see that the trail wanted me to go back up and around a little bit. But I said, if I go up and my phone dies, I don't know how I'm going to get down anywhere. So I just decided to stay on this little creek. And I stayed in the creek. I was running through it. And that's where my toes got so bruised because I was just kicking these rocks and falling over. And I wish I'd filmed it. It would have been great content. But so eventually I saw light in the distance and I was like, oh my God, this is what I was waiting for all day. But as soon as I saw that light, I heard these huge dogs barking.
Oh no.
And I saw this fence in the distance. And I thought, this feels like a scene from a dystopian movie where you're just like coming into this. It looked like I was at the border somewhere. And I realized as well that I was on the wrong side of the river to the town. And wow. I was like, there's no way that I can get over, because it was a big river. It wasn't a small stream that you could wade across. It was pretty wide. And so I was just shouting, please, someone help me, because someone came out to tell the dogs to be quiet. And I was really just shouting and hoping someone heard me. And the light switched off. The dogs went inside. And I thought, did they not hear me? Am I stuck on this side of the river? But eventually the light came back on. Some guy came around and there was a language barrier, but I really tried to explain where I was going, that there's one guest house in this village. And I thought that I would be there like 4 or 5 p.m. It was 10 p.m. I knock on their door completely soaked and covered in mud.
Oh my
gosh. I was like, hi,
oh my.
You're probably expecting me earlier today. But they were so sweet. I brought so much dirt into their house and I still feel bad about that. I tried to wash my pants in the sink because they were just caked in mud and they just wouldn't get clean. It was
maybe you should have crossed that river anyway.
Honestly, yeah. But they were super sweet, gave me food. And then I wrote to everyone that I was okay because everyone was really concerned at that point because it was dark.
Once you got settled in that night and out of your muddy clothes, did you think, maybe I don't want to do this? That was your first taste of this trail?
You know, it was funny because I felt like because I'd done that first day, I could do the other days. I thought nothing was going to be as awful as that bushwhacking and not being able to see a soul the entire day. There's no one up there. It's so remote that there's not even any shepherd camps, which you get in later sections of the trail. And so I think that day, it hurt me a lot physically. And I think I doubted whether I could continue physically because of how much pain I was in with my toes, and I was so scratched because of the bushes and everything and bruised and whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think mentally, I was surprised that I felt like, okay, I think I can do this because I did that first. But it didn't stay that way for the whole time. There were definitely lows after that first day, but it didn't pull me down as much as I thought it might.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely been in situations where I do something truly horrendous and then that just makes me so much more determined. I'm like, well, that's not going to be for nothing that I just did that.
Definitely.
Yeah. So you mentioned a language barrier when you're trying to talk to this guy. You had studied in Armenia. Do you not speak the language at all? Was it difficult to communicate while you're out there?
Well, so I have the advantage that I speak Russian, and a lot of people speak Russian in Armenia. So I think that was really great. And that was something that was a huge advantage to me that I know a lot of other thru hikers haven't had. Hearing other people's stories, there was a much bigger barrier, I think, especially for other women on the trail, not being able to communicate things clearly, I think was really difficult for a lot of people, especially when saying, no, thank you, I don't want to stop for coffee or something like that along the route. Where I felt a lot more comfortable explaining myself and saying, I'm on my way, someone's waiting for me, all these things that you would want to communicate in this situation. But depending on where you are, sometimes people won't speak Russian. And it was in those situations where, especially that first night, where there wasn't a shared language. And that was really tricky because I was in such a vulnerable position after that first day. But by and large, I was able to communicate. Or there would be someone around who spoke Russian who could translate, which was really lucky.
That makes sense. Yeah, I can't imagine trying to do something like this and not speaking the language at all. So kind of going back to the checkpoints and how frequently you're seeing, and obviously you mentioned there was a section where you were self-supported. But aside from that, how much weight were you carrying? Because it sounds like it was dramatically different depending on the day. And there were certain times where you weren't sure if you were going to see anyone. How did you gauge what you were carrying on a day-to-day basis?
So I think the pack probably weighed, at least for the first week or so, it was probably around 5 kilos. And that was mostly water, to be honest, because it's a lot hotter in the south. And especially on that first day where there was a big section without water. And actually, I got pretty dehydrated on the first day as well. So that was a lot of fun. But
yeah,
that was something that was a priority for us, to have enough water all the time. And if anything, carry extra weight, but have that backup water, just because the water sources on the map can vary depending on the season, and they can vary in quality. So unless it's a stream or even streams, right, they're not always running depending on the size. So yeah, it was carrying probably 4 liters of water a day. And then for some of the more remote sections, I would carry more gear, like a bigger emergency blanket, not just the foil one, but a more heavy duty mountain one. And then my rain gear, bear spray, dog spray, all that stuff, and then food. I think the huge benefit of having a team and checkpoints was that on days where they were able to access the roads more easily, they could take a lot of that weight away from me. And that's when I was able to move faster and actually start to run on some sections. And then the middle section through the Gegam Mountains, where we were self-supported, Megan and I, our packs were, mine was 14 kilograms at the start because we had to carry enough food for 4 days. But then because we ate that, I think it dropped to like 10 or something by the end. So that was nice. But we weren't in a position to run with that weight on our backs. We tried some sections, but it was mostly trying to hike quickly.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to run when you have that much weight on your body. You mentioned in that story about the first day, the road access point. And you also mentioned earlier that the route has changed due to security. When I think about going to this region, that's what I'm thinking about, is security and security issues. Can you speak to that? What were your concerns? What things you did to mitigate that? Can you cover that for us?
Sure. So I think it's a very valid concern. And it was something that was also on our list when we were doing a risk assessment. That was one of the things that was really high on the list that we needed to keep an eye on and pay attention to, the ongoing border conflict with Azerbaijan. I always felt pretty safe on the trail because it was further away from roads and borders and things like that. But some of the roads that the team had to go on were very close to the border. I didn't want the team to be at risk because they were supporting me. And so we said, if anything at all changes, because we were monitoring the local news and we'd spoken to people about what the best sources were to do this. But I would say that overall, I didn't feel unsafe being there. I would say that it's a safe place to travel. And part of the reason that we wanted to do this project was to show people what Armenia actually looks like from inside and on these trails and what the nature looks like, especially because it's been in the news so much because of conflict. And that's kind of the lens people look at the region and they say, it's not worth going here. So it was important to us to also show a different side, I guess.
As you've mentioned, you didn't see a lot of people, especially when you were out on the trail. But when you did, what did people think about what you were doing? I'm assuming recreational tourism is not a big industry in Armenia. Were they just totally confused by what you were doing? Did you get to have some conversations there?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak from the Armenian side, and I don't know what people like genuinely thought. I think there was a lot of confusion and a lot of concern, especially being solo female runner, hiker. To be honest, I didn't try to explain the whole project every time I met someone. Yeah, I think it was more just, I'm enjoying this section. I'm hiking because it's beautiful. And there were a lot of questions about why I was alone. And in situations where I didn't want to get into a whole conversation about it, I said, oh, my husband's just coming from the other side. He's hiking from the next town and we're going to meet in the middle. And that kind of calmed people down a bit because some people got quite upset about the fact that I was walking alone. And I would usually not run through the towns because I thought that would just attract even more attention. So I'd walk or hike through towns and then run outside of them. And maybe there is something to be said about long-term highlighting running and that side of things. But the truth of the matter is that most people living in the villages along the trail don't have the means to experience nature the way that hikers are, right? To have the gear to do that, to have the time and the money and the freedom to do that. So it was a very privileged thing to be able to go through their country that way. And obviously, I think tourism is really expanding in Armenia, and outdoor tourism and people going on trails is really, really growing. And there's some amazing work being done both by the Transcaucasian Trail Association, the local team, and then another organization called Hike Armenia. They're doing a lot of work and there's a lot more people going on trails, but I think that that's limited to some particularly established trails. And then the more remote sections of the Transcaucasian Trail, people are still quite surprised to see hikers coming through. But there was one section where I hadn't stopped before. I usually declined offers of coffee or whatever, usually because if it was a man offering, I wanted to make it clear that I was just, you know, like I was, because I was trying to move quickly as well. So I didn't have the luxury of stopping and then be able to put up a tent if I didn't get to the destination in time. So I was trying to move fast. But there was one day where I met a family who were herders up on a mountain. And this was a day where I thought I would have a checkpoint, but the team couldn't get through because of the road conditions. And they offered coffee. And I said, yes. I mean, first I said no. And then they said, no, really, please come in. And they gave me their fresh cheese and coffee. Yeah. And it was amazing. And they had had other hikers come through. So they were aware of the fact that this was a trail that people walked on. And I think it's because it was one of the sections that more people did. Not everyone does a through hike. Some people do certain sections of the trail. And it was great to talk to them. They said that they had all kinds of people coming through, like different nationalities. I think there was a French girl not so long before me. And last year there was several more people. I would say that it's such a beautiful country and a beautiful trail. And like they know that, obviously, like living there. And I think that that was sort of the shared message that we could connect over. I think the team tried to explain what I was doing to a couple people on the way, especially we were staying in a guest house. It wasn't even really a guest house. We only got to stay there because it was a friend of someone that we knew working on the trail that could connect us to this family. And my sister Lisa and Jonas tried to explain the project to this family, and they just totally didn't understand what we were doing. They were so nice and they gave us amazing food and were super hospitable, but I think it was just like, why would you do this?
Right.
And again, like it comes back to having the time and the money and the support and being in a community where this sort of stuff is not normal, but it's not totally unheard of to do something like this, like in the ultra running or like through hiking space.
Right.
So,
yeah. What advice would you have for others who maybe they're not interested in FKT, but who are interested in experiencing the Transcaucasian Trail in Armenia?
So I think that one of the biggest strengths of this trail is its community. And I think that the founders and the team right now who runs the trail have done such a great job of this. They have an online community every year for people who are thinking about through hiking or just hiking sections of the trail. And there's a wealth of knowledge there from people from the last couple of years where people are really proactive about writing trail notes and saying, watch out for this dog on this section, or be aware that the stream is dry, or this is a great camping spot. And I think that because it's such a new trail and because so much changes year on year, and a lot of people are still scared of what they will encounter on the trail or worried about how to deal with it, having this knowledge that is stored in one place and that people are building on actively, and kind of this sense that we're all helping each other experience the trail in a way, I think is such a strength. And if I hadn't had that resource and if I hadn't seen that there were other people who'd thru-hiked, I'm not sure that I would have had the confidence to get to that start line because there was so much doubt that I had, so many unknowns. Like I live in a big city. I don't go up into mountains often. So I had a lot of fear around this trip. Getting to connect with other people who'd hiked was just a huge, huge resource. On top of that, practical tips, buy a pair of shoes that are bigger than you think you need. Everyone yeah. told that to me. And I said, I don't want to buy another pair of shoes. It's expensive. My ultra shoes are already a size too big. They're like, no, you need another size bigger. And that was very much needed. But yeah, just leaning on other people, leaning on the community that's built around the trail and not taking unnecessary risks. That was something that we agreed within the team that we weren't going to do. And that was something that I kept pretty close the whole time. There were some situations where it got a bit close, and in retrospect, maybe I wouldn't have done that. But by and large, we didn't take any unnecessary risks. And I'm really happy about that. I think that anyone who's on the trail, because of how remote it is, because of the lack of search and rescue services, you're really responsible for your own safety. out there. I'm so lucky that I had a team and a tracker who was aware of where I was at any given point. Jonas even said that he knew at every time where the nearest medical center was. I didn't realize that he'd planned to that level of detail, which I'm so grateful for. But yeah, just recognizing that you're responsible for your own safety, better to err on the side of caution so that you can enjoy it more. And because it's a beautiful, beautiful trail. And I was talking to someone about doing it fast and an FKT, and they said, I want to do it as slow as possible. And I think that that's also a great approach to get to experience it fully. So I would actually recommend people to enjoy moments on the trail where possible in beautiful places, because it's really, really special. And every time I think back, I just feel so lucky that I got to be in some of those places. I think it'll really stay with me for my whole life, probably.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show today and sharing. It's been a real pleasure hearing about this trail and hearing your perspective on it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again, Katya, for coming on the show. You can read about her FKT on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and follow her adventures on Instagram at running_Armenia.